It's a pleasure, as always, to welcome Mark Rubinstein to the conversation. Mark, of course, is author of the wonderful weekly newsletter on financial sector themes called Net Interest. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, John.
In your latest article entitled Revolution in the Air, you take a close look at the app Revolut, which aspires to be a financial super app. And I was quite amazed by the history here, and you have some personal history here as well.
Yeah, that's right, John. So Revolut recently received a capital injection, $800 million, valuing the company at $33 billion, which in the UK context is quite remarkable. The press commentary is that this is the largest privately owned tech company in British history. It's certainly right now alongside, behind Stripe, and alongside Klarna, one of the biggest privately owned financial technology companies in the world. And I was an early investor. So I came across Revolut as a consumer, actually not even as a consumer. The app was shown to me back in 2016 by an early investor. Company was launched in 2015. It's kind of founded at the end of 2013, launched in 2015. I came across it in 2016 and had the opportunity to invest in the Series A in 2016.
And just for those listening, if it's not clear by now, that's been a home run. Of course, you haven't had a liquidity event, but I checked and the Series A was actually done, it seems, at a $54 million valuation.
Yes, that's right. There's been some dilution since, but that's right.
And now we're at $33 billion just a few days later.
A few years later, yes.
On par, one might add, with NatWest Group, which is a little bit more established.
Well, this is the interesting thing. So one of the themes I often return to when looking at financial services, and fintech is a big part of that, is the old versus the new. And NatWest, it's not one of the oldest banks necessarily in the UK. It was kind of formed via a merger in the late 1960s. It was part of RBS, so had a torrid time during the financial crisis, came through that. Its market cap is pretty similar. It's $33 billion. Actually, it's a little bit, depending on the day of the week, it's a little bit less than the Revolut valuation at $33 billion. So it raises some interesting questions around the valuation of one company, which is new technology, very interesting app-based user interface, actually has more customers than NatWest. NatWest, in its UK retail banking business, has about 12.5 million customers. Revolut is now global, and we can go on and talk about that, but it has 16 million customers, so it has more customers than NatWest. But like a lot of these new financial technology companies, doesn't make that much money. It hasn't made any profit over a sustained 12-month period. There were a couple of months back end of last year, November and December, where it made money in those particular months, and the revenues were a lot lower than NatWest's. NatWest does £11 billion of revenue in a typical year. Revolut last year did less than a quarter of a billion pounds. So huge difference in revenues, therefore in valuation. But Revolut, like I say, now one of the most sought after from an investor perspective. So the two investors that came in valuing it at $33 billion were SoftBank and Tiger Global, who are the numbers one and two ranked currently for new venture investment so far in 2021.
Fascinating. Tell us about the genesis of Revolut and what the early business was.
Like a lot of financial technology companies, the early business is informed by a particular problem that the founder has experienced. We spoke about Wise, formerly known as TransferWise, a few weeks ago. The issue there was currency transfer cross borders, the idea that one may want to send money home if one is working in a different country. And that becomes very difficult, very expensive to do through the banking system. Revolut tackling a similar problem, slightly different, less the issue of sending money home and more the issue of spending money whilst on holiday. So the founder, Nick Storonsky, Russian national living in the UK, did a trip. He was working for Credit Suisse at the time, did a trip to the United States and ended up spending money as one does on a trip. Afterwards, he did some calculations and estimated that the cost of the foreign exchange transfer fees had been close to $2,000. And so he recognized, like a lot of these founders recognized, that if that was a problem he was suffering, likely it's a problem others are suffering as well. And Revolut initially was a monoline company geared around spending money abroad. And it offered three features which combined made it a very interesting proposition. One was free, or at least very cheap, foreign exchange translation. Two was the ability through a payments card to actually affect that. So, unlike in the case of Wise, where it was done through the banking system, here the user was dispatched a card, a plastic card, a prepaid debit card, and they, let's say they were on vacation on the south of France from the UK, take the card with them, spend the money, and it would be exchanged at kind of the spot mid-market interbank foreign exchange rate. And then the third feature is all of that will be logged as well. So come home from holiday and there'd be a transaction log of what was spent in restaurants and bars and hotels and so on and so forth.
And at that point, Revolut was really just a front-facing app, relying on others to provide the plumbing, correct?
Yeah, and again, not dissimilar from lots of other fintech companies that work on incumbent rails. In this case, Revolut designed a consumer-facing app, but it was just an app. And the back end was satisfied by, there was a company at the time it was listed in London called Paysafe. It was then taken private. Subsequently, it's been SPAC'd. And now trades in the US under its own name again. And they provide a number of services, including virtual card issuance. And so they provided the card, they were the card issuer, they had all the regulatory authorities to issue a card. MasterCard was the brand whose rails were used. Any funds were held on deposit, not at Revolut, but at an account Revolut held within Barclays. So, customer may or may not have known any of this, but it all passed through Revolut, which was the customer acquisition vehicle, if you like.
And it seems that Revolut has over-delivered on the top line, but has basically opted to reinvest and hasn't really delivered a profit as it had initially projected.
Yeah, it's often interesting. It's very interesting always to go back. One of the benefits of being one of the benefits of private investing is the ability to get access and complete transparency to management accounts and to financial projections. And what's interesting, if you compare what Revolut projected it would make in its seed round, and then it's an A series round, and then what ultimately happened, one particular feature stands out, which is that they massively outperformed on revenue. And the reason for that is because they massively outperformed on customer acquisition, but they massively outperformed on revenue, but they didn't make any money. So the seed had them making money in 2017. The A series pushed that out to 2018. And here we are in 2021. And as I said earlier, they haven't made any money yet over a sustained 12-month period. Now, clearly, the market is more accepting of losses than maybe was anticipated when the company initially went to raise funding. But there's been a shift, clearly, whereby the approach has been much more geared towards growing customers, and from that potentially revenues, but growing customers predominantly rather than making money. And the private markets have been willing to fund that.
And what's interesting is Revolut has really tried to be a global money app as early in its life as possible. So it hasn't just focused on the UK.
Yes, that is right. So it's a UK registered company. Right now, they have a banking license in Lithuania, actually, which allows them to, they can passport that into the rest of the EU. They are active in 35 different countries. So I mentioned 16 million customers across 35 different countries, looking now for a banking license in the UK and the US, in addition to the one in Lithuania. So really very global. And as you say, that was an early strategic component whereby they went into France very, very early and built up quite a following in France quite early. Ireland actually right now is the second biggest market after the UK for Revolut globally. One in every two Irish adults has a Revolut account.
And that's a fascinating number because that hints at the potential that exists in other markets as well. And one other thing that I find also quite distinct about this company is just the pace of new product iteration and product launches.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and there is a downside to it as well, but the upside is plain. What Revolut has been able to do is ship new products, as you say, very, very quickly. In 2020, they shipped 15 new products and innovations across their global network. So having started as a multi-currency account, a payment mechanism, a payment card to be able to spend abroad. Very quickly after that, cryptocurrency trading was introduced, stock trading, various kind of bank account features were layered in. A business account was introduced in 2017. Right now, I mentioned that they have 16 million customers. That's on the consumer side. There are 500,000 business customers. There's travel insurance in there. And there's lots of plans to grow products going forward. Now, this is something that the CEO has identified as being the secret weapon, the ability to, in his view, all a business is a set of products. And his view is the faster you can iterate on those products, the faster you can ship those products, that's a competitive advantage. So that's what Revolut sees as a competitive advantage. The downside, of course, is that some growing pains can develop. And there have been some complaints against Revolut that accounts are closed down or they're frozen. Not a direct downside of the product rollout, but just the growth more broadly, that the customer service infrastructure, for example, required to serve 16 million customers is very, very different from the requirement to service 500,000 customers. And there's been a kind of a disconnect in the eyes of some consumers between that growth. So growing very, very quickly is can be a secret weapon, but it does have some downside components to it as well.
And then there's also the potential issue or you know, the issue that's likely down the road of actually needing to put more capital behind the business, which currently is extremely capital light.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not regulated as a bank, as I say, outside of Lithuania, which is still quite a small business. It's regulated as an e-money institution. There are very specific European regulations around e-money institutions, but they don't have to retain as much capital as banks. So to put some numbers on that, Revolut's capital requirement right now is just over £60 million. If it was to become a bank, it would need a lot more capital. Now, clearly, after the $800 million capital injection, they have that capital, but some of it will be used to support the balance sheet rather than invested, which will be the case in a traditional technology company, in the operations.
And so it seems like the long-term ambition is to be a global financial super app, but not just that, but also truly a global bank.
Yeah, exactly. So super app, there's been a convergence, really. A lot of financial technology companies, or call them startup financial companies around the world, often started in a particular product niche. So the example of Revolut, as we've described, was spending foreign exchange. Other examples, so Tinkoff in Russia started out as a credit card business. There are Robinhood, clearly, don't think it necessarily wants to become a super app, but started out doing stock trading, but has actually broadened that and now has ambitions to do other financial services as well. So lots of examples of a kind of convergence towards super app status. Revolut wants to be global. So it's currently in 35 countries. It's increasing the number of countries it goes into. It went into the US, one of the biggest markets in the world, clearly, in 2020. 2 years preparation had gone into that. And then the pandemic happened, but they decided to go ahead anyway. And by the end of the year, they'd picked up 200,000 customers. It's going to be an interesting test case. The track record of non-US banks going into the US is really poor. Frankly, the track record of any bank adopting a global consumer strategy is also quite poor. Best two examples, or the classic two examples, a Citi, which you and I, John, discussed in the past, and HSBC, and both of them have retrenched under new CEOs in each case. They retrenched, and Citi currently is looking to get out of 13 markets, and HSBC recently got rid of its French operations. Very difficult because the regulations in each market are difficult. The culture in each market is different. The propensity to take products and product design is very different in each market. And it's something actually that technology companies, there's a kind of it's almost the opposite. So financial technology is maybe an amalgam of finance and technology. And yet in technology, you have global players. You have a small number of globally active players with billions of customers, for example, in the case of Facebook. Finance hasn't historically been a global business. So creating a global player is an interesting experiment, and there's no real precedent for it.
Who are the other main contenders in this global financial super app category, and how are they differentiated versus Revolut, let's say?
Well, most of the others are regional. So Nubank in Latin America is regional right now around Latin America. Chime, very active in the US, and will be a formidable competitor to Revolut in the US. Tinkoff, as I say, exclusively in Russia right now, and has indicated that they want to expand into some other countries, but will take it slow. Ant has expanded, again, regionally around Asia. So, and has a stake, for example, in Paytm in India. So really, it's been very regional so far. The disadvantage Revolut has, if you like, is that they don't have a core profitable business. So Chime has got debit interchange in the US, which, because they operate via a bank which has got less than $10 billion of assets, is not subject to a regulatory cap on interchange, and so can be more profitable. And therefore, given that structure, that is a very profitable core business where they're making sort of take rates of 1.2%. Tinkoff has got credit cards, as I mentioned earlier, in Russia, Nubank. So Brazil is just inherently a more profitable with higher interest rates banking market. Revolut doesn't have those things. So coming back to the idea of shipping products fast, the flip side is to do lots of products to lots of customers globally in an effort to accumulate revenue and to spread that revenue over that customer acquisition cost.
There's also apps like Square and, you take Robinhood. It seems that any app that gets the customers and has some edge with whatever their main focus is, ultimately decides, hey, we can do more here, and starts converging on this super app model. So how do you look at kind of the long-term landscape there?
Yeah, and again, something I often come back to when looking at financial technology is this notion that there is nothing new under the sun. And in less in the US, where financial services became quite fragmented and retail brokerage was historically done, and this goes back to separation of investment banking and commercial banking by law, but historically in the US there's been a fragmentation where there's been a identifiable mortgage origination market and players that just do mortgage. There's been a retail brokerage market traditionally via Merrill Lynch and Dean Witter and so on. And banking has been quite distinct. In Europe and in Asia, the universal model has been dominant, which has been all about cross-selling and about spreading that customer acquisition cost. Some cases it can backfire because there's a reputational issue, which we saw, and we've discussed this as well, you and I, John, in the past, in the context of Wells Fargo in the US, which kind of modeled its cross-selling strategy on some of the French banks, which had very high levels of cross-selling. So it can be damaged from a reputational perspective. You could argue that with current technology, customer engagement might be higher than it was historically. Certainly the number of times a day a consumer will check their app will be much higher than the number of times a day a consumer would have gone into a bank branch. In the case of Robinhood, people check their app. The average is 10 times a day. And in Revolut's case, the number of daily average users is way over a million. So maybe there is a greater propensity to do the cross-selling, but it's nothing new. And companies like HSBC have tried it before.
Revolut's last round, I believe, featured two very prominent new shareholders, SoftBank and Tiger Global. Those investors tend to come in, when an IPO is almost visible. Do we know anything about the IPO plans here?
Yes, don't know yet, but you're absolutely right. SoftBank maybe less so, but Tiger possibly more so. But no, there's been no indications yet of an IPO, but certainly the market for exits within financial technology has been very ripe recently.
Well, fascinating story, Mark, a story that you're personally connected to. We will keep watching it. Thank you so much for your insights into Revolut.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Bye for now.